Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Thanks to Vodafone Business. With cybersecurity solutions from Vodafone, your business can hack off the hackers. See vodafone.ie/business.
This is News Talk.
Yeah, you're very welcome along to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up over the next hour, the Online Safety Code Part B is coming into action on Monday. What does that entail and will it actually make a difference in keeping our kids safe online? WeTransfer caused a bit of a stir this week with policy updates. We'll look at what happened and their stunning U-turn. Plus, we'll meet the Irish company looking to take the stress out of life after death. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Instagram @JessKellyNT. I'm back from my holidays. I say back, I didn't go anywhere. I basically took 10 days off work. And as ever, there is so much to get through from the world of technology. And this week, I want to start with the Online Safety Code. This is something that has been a long time coming, with a view to making the internet a safer place for everyone, but with a particular emphasis on our young people. The second part of this code is coming into play on Monday, and Alex Cooney of CyberSafe Kids is with me once again to talk through the detail. Alex, it's always great to talk with you. Can you just explain what exactly is coming into effect on Monday and what, if anything, will be different?
So basically, there's two parts of this code, right? So there's part A, which is already in effect. And it sets out some kind of general rules around protecting children from harmful content. And then there's part B, which is the bit that comes into force on Monday. So what Commissioner Mann did was give the platforms who are on that list that, of companies that are going to be accountable under this code, they gave them 9 months effectively to get their house in order. So from Monday, there are going to be specific rules in place around part B of the code, which is dealing with things like age verification, adult content, access to adult content, and then some other aspects like parental control. So that's the kind of that really from Monday, it's all in force and, you know, they're ready to get going, essentially.
I was speaking to Pat Kenny on Tuesday's Pat Kenny Show, believe it or not, and we were talking about a trial that's taking place in 5 countries within the EU to verify the ages of citizens who are looking to access websites that may have sensitive or, you know yourself, adult content, essentially. Yeah, and that's being tested in 5 countries. We're not one of those countries taking part in this trial. So what onus is on the websites, the different platforms from Monday morning in terms of age verification and protection of young people online?
Yeah, so what that test is, I think, part of the Digital Services Act, the rollout of that. So it is confusing to the layman. Like, we've got kind of our national legislation, which is the Online Safety Media Regulation Act, which is where this Online Safety Code comes from. We can only regulate according to our Online Safety Code or according to that law, those entities that are based in the state. So it doesn't cover some of the companies that you may have, you know, like Snapchat, for example, that we know children use, but it would cover like Google and Google services. It would cover Meta and their services and TikTok. So there are definitely a number of services like that children use that will be covered by this Online Safety Code. Then you've got the Digital Services Act, which covers a kind of broader range of services across Europe. And we have a special responsibility in Ireland for regulating those entities based in the state. So the digital wallet that's in the works and likely to come on stream in 2026 is supposed to be a kind of privacy preserving way of checking your identity and giving a signal to the platforms that you are of age. And it's specifically at this point anyway for 18 plus. So it's kind of under 18 and over 18. And I believe the trial that's being proposed in those countries is to kind of have a national version of that. And I think in Ireland, the plan is to also have a national version of that. How it works in practice is perhaps more complex because there is this country of origin principle, which means that you can Ireland is supposed to only be regulating those entities based in the state of Ireland. So, if we're talking about, for example, a commercial porn provider, they are largely in other countries, so Cyprus, Czechia. So it's not so clear how that's going to work. If we want to ensure there's age verification, is that going to is it those countries that are going to put that age verification in place, or is it going to be sort of more centralized than that, or can we in fact say actually on the basis of protecting minors we can impose age verification requirements on any adult service? So it's not totally clear. Is I hope I probably confused
No,
your question.
you've explained it well, and I suppose the fact of the matter is that it's not super clear. And one of the points that I've been thinking about quite a bit over the last little while is that, yes, the Online Safety Code is extremely important, and I do think it will do good work. But the fact that it only covers those entities, as you've mentioned there, that have a base here in Ireland or HQ here in Ireland is worrying, because we know that the internet doesn't have boundaries. And so if you are determined, eager, interested to access certain types of content, if you can't get it on one website without verifying your identity, you will easily get it on another.
Yeah, that's it. And it is quite complex. And actually, what I would like to see is legislation that is focused on where children are, and ideally at the European level. So even with the Digital Services Act, there's still a lot of leeway being left to individual companies. And some of the most popular places that children go online, so think of gaming platforms like Roblox, Minecraft, these are incredibly popular places for children to go online. But they are not subject to the same level of scrutiny and regulation that bigger services. So they've got this 45 million monthly subscriber threshold. So even though they are subject to some regulations, they aren't subject to things like risk assessments, which, when you're thinking about kids and risks, obviously, it would be, to my mind, pretty important that an online environment that children are going into is subject to risk assessments, and that they are putting in place protective measures to protect children from risks within those online environments. So I do think we definitely haven't quite, even though we're now in an era of regulation as opposed to what was before, which was self-regulation, I still think quite a lot is left up to the companies to determine. Now, none of our laws are very prescriptive. So, whether you're looking at the Digital Services Act or indeed the Online Safety Code, when you think about handling complaints and that sort of thing, it's not prescriptive. So, one of the questions you asked me at the beginning is, okay, what's going to be different from Monday? And it's really hard to know, actually. Like, is that when the kind of negotiation begins between Commissioner Mann and these companies? Or is the expectation that any service that has adult content like X should have that in place? Now, obviously, X is in a legal dispute with Commissioner Mann at the moment, so and they've just been given a bit of extra time to get their house in order. But yeah, it's I think, as we've already said, there's a lot that isn't clear, and to my mind, there is more that we could be doing to regulate online environments that children specifically are going into.
Yeah, I suppose this is what I don't necessarily understand, is that, like, I have my passport for when I travel, and if I get into trouble, there's embassies, there's processes and procedures that are in place that exist that I can avail of. And it seems like, and I know some people will be allergic to this idea, but it does seem like that idea of a digital passport to have it to access and just verify your age. The trial that I mentioned there on the PacKenny show on Tuesday, it is anonymized. It's essentially a handshake between my device and the website I'm trying to access, verifying that I'm over 18. My device doesn't tell the website who I am, what I am, or anything like that. And the website doesn't tell my device or anybody what the website is, what service or product or whatever it is I'm looking to access. That, to me, makes the most amount of sense. The new aspects of both the Online Safety Code and the Digital Services Act, they do still seem to be, for want of a better phrase, a bit loosey-goosey. And I think what we're going to find is stuff will fall through the cracks. And I anticipate Commissioner Mann hearing from parents or siblings or concerned appropriate adults who think something is in breach of the code, but it's actually not, because it is so loosey-goosey.
Yeah, I think you're right. And there's still kind of discussions, arguments underway around where this technology should sit. The likes of Meta have long argued that it should sit at the App Store level. And I think that's where the digital wallet is going to sit at the kind of device level. And as you say, give this signal almost. So it's still protecting the identity of the user, which is really important because I know one of the big arguments against having age verification in place was this kind of breach of privacy and this idea that you're kind of getting into a nanny state type era. But this, to my mind, does tick those boxes of being anonymized and protected and not sharing additional data with those companies because they obviously have plenty of data already on us. But yeah, it's not clear what Ireland will be doing from Monday. Or what their requirement will be on the likes of X, which is one of the services on that list, which does allow adult content. And then there's kind of gray areas too. I mean, there's plenty of online services that maybe unwittingly have adult content on them. Maybe it's against their terms and conditions, but it's there anyway. And children are still able to access it. So it's not all being picked up and removed. It is still there. What happens there as well? Like, what are the obligations? And I think this is even reading the guidelines around the implementation of Article 28 for the Digital Services Act, which deals with children. It's not totally clear what you're supposed to do for these more gray areas. Like, is it age assurance? Is it age estimation? I mean, age verification is only going to be required for the explicitly clear adult content. I think there's still a lot of gray area.
So, are we happy in that there is progress being made, but not done with the fight because there's more that could be done?
Yeah, like I think we have to obviously wait and see what will be different as a result. Now there is no more waiting, there's no more getting your house in order. Now it is live in theory, with the exception of X, which is going through this legal process with Commissioner Mann. So that has to be resolved, I imagine, before the requirements will be fully in place. But I think there's an element of waiting and seeing, but I don't think we should be waiting forever. Like, I do think there should be very clear, like, 12-month milestones, 24-month milestones. What difference is this making? How effective is it in its stated intention of protecting children from harmful content and, ensuring that they can't access some of this more inappropriate adult type content? And that, there's that question. And then there's questions around the recommender system, which isn't explicitly dealt with by the Online Safety Code. That's being left up to the kind of Digital Service Act, European Commission level. But I do think we need these regular reviews to see, is it working? What could be done to tighten it up? Because one of the proposals that, or the one of the provisions that was in the legislation was for an individual complaints mechanism. And I think we've talked about this before, but that would give users greater control. So when they make a complaint to a platform over something that they consider to be harmful, maybe it's bullying material or something like that, what would be, if they don't get an adequate response or any response from that platform, an individual complaints mechanism would allow them to take that complaint to Commissioner Mann, who could, in theory, issue a notice to that company to take that content down. But we don't yet have that in place, and we don't even have clear timeframes. So we don't know what is a reasonable timeframe for a response. What's a reasonable expectation in relation to removals? So, without those kind of parameters, it's going to be difficult to put in place an individual complaints mechanism. But my hope is that in the future, we will have something like that.
Yeah, and I think that is something that I know parents listening to this now will be, I suppose, still having a list of questions, because if your child sees something that's upsetting, or if your child is being cyberbullied and there's images of them or videos of them being posted online, every minute that that's up is too long. And so to not have a clear understanding of the processes and how it's all going to work, that's, I suppose, that's the comfort blanket that some parents are still waiting for.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the thing. Like, if you don't establish what reasonable is, we're still kind of just feeling our way around in the dark. Like, we don't know, well, what should the expectation be? So if the company doesn't respond at all or just sends a sort of holding email, What are the steps? Now, you can call Commissioner Mann if you're not happy with your the response time, but they don't have any power at the moment to do anything about it. What I suppose they would do is log the case and kind of keep an eye on, is there a particular company that's particularly problematic in this area? But what, of course, when you're in those situations, you want it done now, especially when it's in relation to a child. And it could be something that's gone viral. It could be a bullying campaign. We've had dealt with plenty of cases of this nature, and they all have that same sense of urgency because it involves a child, and it's really causing upset and harm to that child. So the quicker you can get that content removed, the better. So I do think we need to put more onus on companies to have a far greater responsibility for content on their platforms that's harming children in particular, for a better user experience for everybody, but for children in particular. So, yeah, what we have, I don't think is perfect by any means. Of course, we have to give it a chance to work, see what difference it makes. But I do want to see those reviews, on a regular basis to make sure it is doing what it is supposed to be doing.
I suppose the final point here is what we always end up talking about, which is education. And although, as we said, this is progress, it's not perfect. And as we approach another school year, it's always a good idea for parents to educate themselves, go to websites and resources such as your own, and there are plenty of signposts there to try and help people navigate tricky situations, new technologies, and all the rest. But the onus does still seem to be on the parent to use this opportunity to get across the different scenarios that could, and in some cases, will arise.
Yeah, and look, there's a couple of things there. So parents absolutely have a vital role to play, because often they're the ones determining when children are going to get that first access, the levels of access they have, where they're using devices and so on. So they do have a really important role, and it is important that as a society we are supporting and upskilling them, because it is a new, as we've said many times, it's a new area of parenting, and we need parents to kind of move with that and be there to support their child along the way. And sometimes parents feel really overwhelmed by that, and so we've got to ensure that they've got all the resources available to them to be able to do that as effectively as possible. But there was a recent study by ESRI, which well there's more an amalgamation of studies, but they considered quite a number of academic articles. I think it was 300 or 400 pieces in their review. And one of their findings, they kind of focused on a number of areas, but parenting was one of them. And what they said is, their conclusion was, even the most informed parents could not do this on their own. What we need is a whole society approach. We need parents absolutely playing their part and doing their role and feeling equipped and having to have the, to support their children online. But there is this broader piece where we need children to be educated in schools with a strong critical digital media literacy curriculum. We need, obviously, the companies doing their part, which is what we've spent most of this conversation about, is their role in ensuring children are going to have safe and positive online experiences. So it is that broader societal piece that we need to ensure happens. And I really hope we'll see substantial changes around all of those areas over the next few years.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, we will continue to bring you updates if and when we get word from the likes of Commissioner Mann and the social platforms about the changes and indeed the difference that it makes. But for the moment, Alex Cooney of CyberSafe Kids, thank you so much for joining me here on News Talk.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'd love to hear from you. Are you a parent navigating this space? Are you comfortable and confident in terms of finding the right supports if and when something goes wrong? Do you believe that platforms will be safer on Monday as a result of this code? You can email me techtalk@newstalk.com. I'd also love to hear from parents who have been through this. They're not going through it right now, but have been through this. Have you had to reach out for support? What was the issue? Where did you turn? Were you supported? Again, the email address is techtalk@newstalk.com. Now, when we come back here on News Talk, we'll hear from the Irish company that's helping families navigate life after death.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Earlier this week, Netflix published its top 300 shows of the year so far. And in news that will shock nobody, I'm sure, adolescents sat firmly at the top. If you're not one of the 145 million people who watched it, here's a clip.
Jamie, this is our last session.
What?
But what I would encourage you to do, whatever happens next, is take advantage of any mental health services that are offered to you.
Why?
I think you'll benefit from
thinking more
about
it. No, I won't.
Well, that's just what I think.
And then you come back. You see me?
Unfortunately, I'm needed elsewhere.
Wait, it's just like fucking done, is it?
I hope you take what I said seriously. Thanks for your time. I'll ask Frank to come back in now.
Frank, for my time!
Frank, and honesty, I'm grateful that
you think I'm being honest? Are you going to tell the judge all that?
I think you've spoken to me with honesty, yes, but all I'm advising the judge on is your understanding.
My understanding, yes. It doesn't seem like a proper goodbye.
It is.
It doesn't seem like one.
Yeah, that's enough, come on.
No, we haven't finished.
We have, thank you.
No, can I ask you something?
Yes.
Do you like me?
I was here as a professional,
Jamie. Don't you think like that, then?
My job was to assess
you. I like you.
As a professional.
Not like that, not fancying you. Just as a person.
Okay, come on.
Don't you even like me a bit? What did you think about me then? Decide, come
this
on!
This was really useful.
Yeah, that is the fantastic Adolescence, which is the most watched show on Netflix so far this year. We were talking through the list here in the office in terms of what we've seen and not seen and all the rest. And this won't surprise you, I'm sure, but I haven't seen many of them. A controversial one that sits firmly at the top of the list is Squid Game. I know it has a cult following and it's massively popular, but I just never got it. I still don't understand what it is. I don't get it. I just read sort of one or two line reviews and decided it wasn't for me. But we've been watching a series on Netflix. It's a documentary series called Trainwreck, and there's a mix of all kinds of everything in this series. Like a wide range of stories are the subject of each episode of the documentary series, and there's one that I'd recommend to you if you've not watched it already, because you might remember this story. It's called Trainwreck: The Real Project X.
Let's go. Everybody was jumping, drinking beer, having fun. The energy just made a 180 all of a sudden.
People just went berserk.
Was completely out of control.
Oh my God, they are gonna destroy everything.
I was very worried they would reach the house and destroy whatever they could. Just burn it down, pretty much like in the movie.
Yeah, that is a snippet from Trainwreck, The Real Project X. This documentary tells the story of a party that was organized on Facebook 13 years ago to celebrate a girl's 16th birthday party. It went massively viral on Facebook with thousands of people showing up for the party. It is quite literally my worst nightmare. But the documentary is fascinating because you get to meet the woman whose party it was. You get to see some of the key instigators that led to it going viral. You get to understand how the Facebook system worked back in the day. And then obviously the fallout from it all as well. So it is utterly fascinating. And again, it is called Trainwreck, The Real Project X. As always, I'm on the hunt for recommendations from you. You can drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com. Or don't forget, you can get me on Instagram as well, @JessKellyNT. There's quite a few questions that have come in while I was away, and I'm going to try and get through as many of them as I can later in the show. But now I want to talk about a new digital platform that is offering support and advice to families on the practicalities that we're all going to have to face with after a funeral of a loved one. It's called The Next Steps, and I'm delighted to say that Cullum Kieran, the co-founder of My Farewell Wishes, is with me now. Cullum, it's great to chat to you on the show. This is an area that I don't love talking about. It kind of goes without saying. I don't love talking about death, thinking about death, anything like that. But it's something that we will all encounter at some stage. Before we get into the new product, can you just give me a bit of a background? What's your own story?
I am a funeral director myself in King's Court in County Cavan. Mm. And it's a family-run business. It's very typical of the vast majority of funeral businesses around the country, which are what you might call part-time funeral businesses, where we would also generate an income. Let's say my dad would have been an auctioneer as well as a shopkeeper. And the other types of funeral businesses around the country would be, you know, hardware shop owners, publicans, and they would have the funeral business as a complementary business to that. Around the country then, in the large urban centres, you have your larger funeral businesses, full-time funeral businesses. But that's the type of business I would have grown up in. Mm. I studied engineering in college. Two years of that would have been computer science in Trinity within the engineering department. So I would have been getting the very basics in website design at the time, HTML, you know, building basic 1-2 page websites, doing a bit of C++ and Java programming. And I've branched into civil engineering after that. And I went back and did a business course in UCD Smurfit in 2006, 2007. And that's where I got into a business development role after that, still within civil engineering. I was working for a company called CHM. We're now the largest provider of traffic management services in the country on the roads. And in 2011, I moved back to the family business to help out my dad at the time, and took over the family business and got involved with the Irish Association of Funeral Directors through a course that I attended in 2013. And through that, I've developed a network of contacts really around the country. But I always had it in mind to provide complementary services to funeral directors as a sideline and complementary business to our own funeral business here, based on my background and my training and education experience that I had got to that date. And in 2020 then, I got involved in providing digital services for funeral directors, particularly during the pandemic. We were starting to do basic web design for funeral directors around the country. And I noticed, like, I had previously been spokesperson for the National Association, but I noticed that there was a real gap between the funeral directors who are providing really top-class services one-to-one and their digital profiles and their digital skills, and how ultimately they communicate with their communities, who age profile-wise were much more digitally savvy and connected. And yet funeral directors were now starting to deal with family members of the deceased who were that age profile, Generation X, Millennials, and now Gen Z, who would be at a different level of competence to a lot of the funeral businesses around the country. So with the pandemic, I actually developed a piece of software at the time called the Virtual Funeral Arranger, which allowed funeral directors to make and gather information for funeral notices virtually. So I developed a little link that funeral directors could send it to a family member on WhatsApp, and they would provide the inputs for funeral notice. So names, spellings, relationship to deceased, upload a photograph for RIP. And it meant that when they would fill that out and press submit, the funeral director then got a notification saying, well, these are the details the family has just provided. Very successful with some funeral directors. Other funeral directors were really against it because it felt as though it was removing the personal touch. Mm. But I'm always of the opinion that these tools are out there to complement what we already do as funeral directors.
I suppose that is an interesting point, and it's something that, you know, touch wood, and I'm very lucky that I'd never really thought about what goes into planning a funeral, where you start. It's something that we will all encounter at some stage. But as you said there, you know, for certain people, it's their first time, and a lot of us would go to Google and just try and figure out how do we go about navigating it. So with that initial idea that you had, how did you balance the personal touch, the respectful touch and tone alongside the technological offering?
Well, what we did at the time, we actually shelved that project because at the end of 2020, the opportunity came up for me to launch a funeral pre-planning business in Ireland because there was a company called Golden Charter who pulled out of Ireland in providing pre-planning services using a trust fund in order to manage money. And they pulled out in 2020, and it left a gap in the market to have an Irish-based funeral pre-planning service, which would be run through funeral directors across the country, and we basically would provide the backup service to facilitate that. But I always felt that a digital solution to complement that service was very important to, because I had first-hand experience as a funeral director of running the likes of Facebook campaigns to let people know that this service was available in the local area, and I found a massive interest in finding out about the things that you need to do to pre-plan a funeral if it could be done online. If you could make that initial contact through a website or a Facebook form where you could break the ice. Like, it's a very difficult thing for a lot of people to pick up the phone and ask a funeral director, listen, can I come in and talk to you about my funeral arrangements? And I know that from firsthand, whereas I always felt if we were going to launch a pre-planning service, that digital tech was very important to help people break the ice. So it took us about 2 years to get the legalities and the forms and guidance and a network of funeral directors across the country to be able to have physical forms on desks. And what we then start to do in the last 2 years is start to use Google Ads and Facebook Ads and Facebook campaigns across the country with local funeral directors to make people aware that this service is available. And what we had from 2020 was an explosion of Facebook profiles for funeral businesses across the country who realized it was a really important way to engage within their local communities on a very easy way and where their communities are, which is the most important thing, which you've had a massive migration of Generation X and baby boomers and older onto to Facebook, where RIP.ie is almost like their gateway to the internet for a certain generation. But we find that Facebook profiles for funeral directors, in order to publish funeral notices on their own platforms instead of handing over to a third party like these funeral notice providers, has been a very important way for funeral directors to be able to have their own profile online and be able to do it in a live and their own branded platform. So through that process, we discovered the whole principle of aftercare, funeral aftercare, because we noticed a lot of pre-planners who were contacting us through their local funeral directors had gone through a bereavement themselves, and that was their motivation for wanting to pre-plan their own. And anecdotally, we were having conversations with these people who had gone through not only the aftermath and wanting to pre-plan, but the whole logistics and administration side of having to look after the estate of their loved one. So having to cancel their bank accounts, change names on bank accounts, cancelling pensions, dealing with the dreaded companies like AIR in order to close accounts, and the lack of sensitivity that there are, and starting at zero and having to explain themselves every single time about why they're contacting. Legal affairs. So knowing what probate is, knowing what an estate is, knowing who to contact in the days and weeks after a funeral, knowing how to get grant supports, access to finance. And we found as we started to investigate it that there was all of this information was available online in different places, but it was quite hard for somebody to navigate their way around. So our idea was provide this service through funeral directors on a branded white label platform that effectively looked and felt as though it was the funeral director's own platform, in such a way that it could be sent out by a simple WhatsApp message or email to the family in the days after a funeral, so that when they do sit down and try and figure out, okay, funeral's over, cremation's over, what do we do next? That they can go through our platform and start on a step-by-step basis to find out what they need to do. And we would have started off with a very, very simple tool of creating a one-page PDF that had a checklist on it. And I suppose we've built the whole platform around that concept.
And you mentioned there at the beginning sort of the due diligence that you guys needed to do. I assume that everything that is on this site, you have ensured that it is all by the book and you're referencing best practice for dealing with service providers or banks or pensions or revenue or whatever it may be. And that is something that is updated as and when it needs to be.
Yeah, and it's a very important point that, you know, the information has to be up to date, it has to be relevant, and it has to be the correct information too. So we've spent the last 12 months actually researching and finding the right information, putting it together, getting it checked. And that's why our it's a free service to the general public when they access it through the local funeral director. The funeral director is charged a subscription fee each year for having it. And one of the main reasons for having a subscription fee is that it's always live and it's up to us. It's our responsibility to keep it up to date and relevant then.
And the fee to the funeral directors, is that something that just from the work and the engagement, and obviously you're so established now within that network, that they are willing, ready and able to engage with that subscription and avail of it completely?
Yeah, and that's what we suppose we've been trying to test America and figure out what price point hits for them. Because there are such different types of funeral directors across the country, what we've introduced is a subscription fee that's based on the number of average number of funerals that they look after per year. So that it's not one price for everyone. It's based almost on a per use basis. So a funeral director who's using it or could potentially use it 30 times a year is obviously charging a much different subscription fee to a funeral director who's using it 150 times a year. So it just makes it accessible to as many funeral directors as possible and therefore as many of their bereaved families as possible.
Yeah. And as I mentioned at the top, this is an area that is so delicate, so upsetting. Sometimes, in some instances, people get brought in to deal with the admin side of things that, you know, they don't have the capacity to do or they don't have the capability to do. Is this an information source or is it beyond that?
It's an information source primarily.
Yeah.
What we have from that then is that there are, and we'll be adding some service providers to it. So the likes of people who provide probate services, we're in talks with them at the minute so that people can then be referred on. We have one of the gaps we identified as well is that there's lots and lots of grief support information out there for people. But again, it's in lots of different organizations, websites. And what we've done, we've put all the free grief services available on one platform so that people can go onto it and find out and get signposted to the likes of the brilliant organizations like the Irish Hospice Association. But the other gap that we identified was that we have thousands of trained and accredited counsellors who offer private practice across the country. And a lot of those specialise in grief services. So we've actually, within our platform, put together a website called griefconnect.ie, which is a website which provides a network database of counsellors who provide not only face-to-face, but also online private practice grief support for people who aren't able to get beyond the normal processes that people who experience a bereavement will find that sometimes people need an extra bit of support. And again, that's accessible through our platform.
Yeah. In terms of the business side of things, because obviously you mentioned this is something that your father was involved in and with for a long time. Is this sort of vocational for you now to stay in this industry and carry it on? Or is it the techie side of your brain that just sees an opportunity and it's a good business model?
It's both, because I think if you didn't have an understanding and a love for the kind of market that you serve, there's not much point in being in it. Like, I would be passionate about the fact that small funeral businesses like ours would struggle with tech and also struggle with their viability and the generational effects of, you know, older generations and younger generations not wanting to take on a family business. And being able to support small regional funeral businesses, I think, is a very important thing to do, because we're embedded within communities. We know the families that we look after so well that it becomes much more than just a job, because you get to know people so well through your interactions that you have with them. But as I suppose, as a complementary part to that, for me as a business owner, for me to be able to support that type of funeral director around the country and beyond, but also to be able to generate an income from that, I think is a worthwhile thing for me to pursue.
Yeah. Well, the new service is available. It's called The Next Steps, and it's being offered by participating funeral directors across the country. Cullum, it's been fantastic to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining me here on News Talk.
Thank you.
Now, when we come back here on News Talk, I'll answer your tech questions.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Now, we just have a few minutes left in the show. I'm going to answer your tech questions in just a quick second. If you have any for me, techtalk@newstalk.com is the email address. But before we get to the questions, I want to just talk briefly about a story that caught my eye this week, because it's something that was going to and possibly still could impact me, and I'm sure a lot of you listening as well. And it involves an online product called WeTransfer. Essentially, WeTransfer is an online platform, a website that lets you send big files very easily and for free. I use it all of the time, like genuinely all of the time. Say, for example, when I was in America with Kieran with Ireland Gateway to Europe back in May, I was recording bits and pieces and sending it back to my colleagues here at News Talk via WeTransfer. And that's because the files are big, blah, 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 blah. Super simple, very free, very easy. But the company faced a huge backlash this week because it updated its terms of service. These are the emails that land in your inbox. We get them and we talk about them often enough, like when Meta does something or when X does something, when they update their terms of service, a lot of us ignore them. But some nerdy people like me tend to read the fine print. So WeTransfer sent out an update to its terms of service that was due to take effect on August 8th. And the language used freaked a lot of people out because it mentioned a perpetual royalty-free license to use user content for improving machine learning models that enhance content moderation. Now, this caused havoc, particularly like from people in my world, so in the world of news, journalists, freelancers, artists, creatives, musicians, the whole shebang. They were all up in arms because there's a fear that the work that they're sending could be used without consent or without payment. A lot of people took to the internet to express deep concern and frustration and fear about this. So then the company came back and they removed the AI-related language from the terms. It clarified that it does not use user content to train AI, nor does it sell or share the files with third parties. So the updated terms now state that user content may be used only to operate, develop and improve the service. So that mention of machine learning is gone. But it's a good reminder that I suppose we need to be eyes wide open for the next God knows how long, I suppose, because a lot of companies will be using our content to train AI models. We know that there's already been talk about this from Meta. There was, you know, there's the opt-out feature now if you didn't want Meta AI to learn from your Instagram posts or your public social posts. But this is going to start happening. Think about the online services that you use. Do you want them using AI or using your data to train AI? Now, again, to clarify, WeTransfer is saying that that's not the case here. But it was just an interesting conversation this week. And I was delighted to see that people caught it and that they reacted. And then, of course, that WeTransfer back down as well. But yeah, wild times. Right, we are very much up against the clock, but let me run through some tech questions. First one here from Deirdre. Hi Jess, my teenager is due her first smartphone. I want something affordable, durable and with good parental controls. What are the best options right now for under 500 euro? So Deirdre, the good news is that there are plenty of options out there. I always recommend getting a refurbished phone for a teenager because although they're still a few hundred quid, it is not €1,000, right? I am a big fan of the parental controls that come as standard on iPhone. So you can get an iPhone 13 for less than 500 quid. on the likes of mintplus.ie or Refurbed, which was on the show 2 or 3 weeks ago now. So I would look at an iPhone 13. In terms of the parental controls, and I know this because I set it up for my own niece and nephew a few weeks ago. So if you go for an iPhone 13 for your daughter, when you're setting up the phone, it'll ask you straight out of the box if you're setting it up for yourself or for someone else. And if you hit for someone else, it'll say if it's a child, and then you can put the parental controls in place. If you have an iPhone yourself, you'll be able to go in and see things like how much time they're spending on their phones. You'll be able to see what apps they're using. You'll be able to put limits in place, time limits in place. So if you don't want them on Snapchat for more than 2 hours a day or whatever it is, you can put that in place. You can also have different things like making sure that they're not holding the phone too close to their face. There's, like, I have to say, Apple have done it really, really well in terms of the parental controls. So yeah, that would be my recommendation there. iPhone 13 from mintplus.ie, and then set the phone up as for a child from the outset. Next, Jess, my niece is starting college in September and needs a reliable laptop for coursework, video calls and streaming. What's the best value for money laptop under €600? Okay, I can't believe we're at back to school, back to college conversation time already, but there are so many different options out there, right? That goes without saying. The key thing to figure out before you spend a cent is if there will be any particular software requirements within the college course. So I don't know, for example, if she's doing architecture or, you know, video editing or something like that, because sometimes there will be specific software needed that needs a certain spec laptop. I'm assuming, because you haven't mentioned it here, that that's not the case. So if she's just looking for a laptop that is a bit of an all-rounder and will last for, say, 3 years of a college degree, there are plenty out there. So there's one that I was looking at. I was up in Carrick Mines the other day, and I saw it's the HP Pavilion SE14. And this is a very good laptop. It's €429. It has an Intel Core i3 processor inside, a solid state drive, 8 gigs of RAM, a HD screen. And now the battery life says it's up to 8.5 hours. I don't know if you'll get 8.5 hours out of it. I sometimes find that these battery estimations are slightly exaggerated, but it is fantastic. So that's one. The other thing that I would look at, and again, this is just going off the information that I have in your email, is that she could potentially use a Chromebook. So I did arts in college, and if I was doing an arts degree in college again, I would get a Chromebook, because everything that I would be required to do could work from that. So there's the Acer one, the Acer 314. That's less than €200. 3 cent less, but still less than €300. And that would be absolutely ideal for someone doing an arts degree. So just double check what, or if there are any particular requirements and what they are, and then work from there. But we will have a full back to college, back to school guide starting in the next few weeks here on Newstalk. So do make sure you stay tuned for that. But I hope those recommendations help in that particular case. But that's it from me this week. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back in full on the Go Loud app. Just search for Tech Talk. You'll also find the podcast in all the usual places. I'm going to be back with Shane and Kira on Monday's News Talk Breakfast. But in the meantime, have a great weekend.